Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you. I'm Graham. If you don't know me, I'm pastor of a church in Cambridge, a church plant. We're 10 years old now. I don't know when we stopped saying we're a church plant. But anyway, we're a church. And I'm also on the faculty at Oak Hill College in North London. Just to say, I'm going to put some stuff on the screen. You know, obviously, feel free to scribble things down. I've got some quotes and other things. I'm going to have happily make all the slides available to you, and I'll give you a QR code at the end where you can download those. So if you want to just sit back and enjoy, you can get that stuff later. The description for this session said that current scandals were shaking our ecclesiological convictions. I don't know what you made of that as a kind of description. I felt mine was one of the more enigmatic seminar descriptions. I'm not entirely sure what you think you've come to. Something about the doctrine of the church and something about scandals, apparently. How does that work? The way it was explained to me, and the way I hope you may have understood it so that you've come to the right thing, is that revolves around leadership and some of the scandals about misuse of power and position. And one of the questions it's raised is, are we in danger because of our independency, our church polity? Do we need more oversight? But it also, as you start to think about it, leads on to questions about how power works within churches and the way those scandals have broken. How does plural eldership work? What oversight and accountability is there in church? How does congregationalism play into this? Now, let me just say straight off that in dealing with all of that stuff, we're dealing with some of the structures and systems of church life. And the whole point is we want to be convictional about that, our doctrine of church and how we think church should function. And that's what we're going to get into. That's our territory. No church polity will save you. No system will save you. Sin will always find a way, as it were. So let's just say that straight off, okay? If you go back and get your policies and your relations to other churches, other things we'll talk about, you get them all sorted, you could still misuse your position badly. Because that's to do with our hearts and our characters. So I'm going to mention that a little bit at the end. But I've been asked to talk about the doctrine of the church and these kind of systems, and so that is where we're going to focus, because while they won't save us, they'll be healthier and less healthy and, in fact, unhealthy systems and structures and ways of working. And that's what we're getting into. It's worth just noting that the doctrine of the church has been taken very seriously in independency. In many ways, it's the motivation behind independency. Our ecclesiology has led to independency in this country. Following the Reformation, the Puritan cry was that the Church of England was a church only halfly reformed. It was reformed in its soteriology, doctrine of salvation, but not its ecclesiology. And it was a concern over that kind of church polity that led to dissent and people agitating to become Presbyterians and then also Congregationalists and Baptists. And for Baptists, you then add believers' baptism, and that links for them to the membership of the church, the makeup of the church, and how the church operates. It links in with congregationalism. Now you have a group of covenanted believers who can decide things together. Ecclesiology led to their whole way of working. And later centuries, the 19th century, the Brethren, seeing things in the New Testament, they thought about New Testament leadership and so on, and so reforming the church. My point is simply, we have a strong history of our ecclesiology, our doctrine of church, lying behind our independency, our way of doing things. And that's a good and a right thing. We want to affirm our convictions on these things, which is basically to say we want to beware either traditionalism, where we simply perpetuate what we've always done. And that And that, by the way, doesn't have to be necessarily very old. We're a 10-year-old church plant. We will already have our own traditions, and it may be safest and easiest for us just to perpetuate them. Traditionalism or pragmatism, where you just do whatever you think works. Potentially one of the dangers of the moment is, because of some of these scandals and questions that get raised, we go, well, it's not working, so let's change. Now, I think a better way to go is to say that experience and events raise questions about how we're working, and so we want to ask those questions, sharpen our understanding of whatever principles we believe are involved and how they work out. Make sure perhaps we're not tied into a certain way of doing something that we don't need to be. That'd be traditionalism. Make sure we don't jump into another way of doing things that would actually deny some of our convictions. That would be pragmatism. So let's move to the current challenges. And those challenges, as in the write-up on this seminar, are around leadership. Poor leadership, clumsy leadership, unfortunately even abusive leadership. It's raised questions specifically about how leaders and churches operate, and hence, as I've said, whether our convictions about independency are right and workable today. I'd like to get you thinking occasionally at points in this, rather than just hearing me talk at you for an hour. With your neighbour for a moment, where do you think the current challenges are in that area? Where do you feel the pressure, or where are your questions over that? With your neighbour for just 1 second, go for it. Okay, let's draw back together, and I'd love to hear a couple of your thoughts. We'll need to keep things brief at this stage. We're just getting going and opening up the issues. We have a couple of roving mics. I'd just love to hear a couple of thoughts of what you're saying. Just if people will be bold enough to raise a hand, and we'll have some roving mics. I'll point people out. Come on, someone say something. Thank you. Richard. If anyone else wants to raise a hand, we're going to bring another mic to you. So maybe someone on this side, raise a hand. Richard.
Hello. Yes, hello. Yes. I guess it's the sense of, if someone feels they have been treated badly by leadership, what do leaders say in response to that? So mm-hmm. It's the whole, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? So someone says, I've been treated badly. Leadership I've experienced either in this church or elsewhere has been abusive. I don't trust, you know, elders. I don't trust whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's how you speak when, in a sense, you are in a position of influence and power.
Yeah.
But you want also to push back on some of that.
Yep.
And just your very role means it's hard to respond to some of that.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's really helpful. Thank you. Other comments? Somebody at the front here. Thank you.
We believe that our church leaders are appointed by God. So how then do we challenge if something seems to be going wrong?
Yeah. Thank you. We believe they're appointed by God. Paul says to the Ephesian elders that the Holy Spirit has made them overseers. And yet Paul can also rebuke Peter in public, can't he? In Galatians 2, because he thinks he's got something so wrong. Believing our doctrine about church leadership and believing our doctrine of sin at the same time is going to be key here. Let's go for somebody just here, and then we'll come to you at the back.
Thank you, Mike. I'm Bournemouth, but supporting an elder in a church in another part of the country.
Yeah.
And they're trying to work through challenges that some in the church feel they have with a pastor. And before I was involved, already engaging outside the church organisations for accountability.
Yeah.
And it's been extremely tricky for them.
Yeah.
And also when you come in and advise partway through, it's a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. At the back?
Just thinking, we obviously believe in independency, but at what point is it appropriate and what's your biblical framework for thinking in this way to invoke outside help?
Yeah, thank you. Which comes back to the point at the front. Thank you. Maybe one more. There's one right in the middle there. I'm not sure which one of you is closest. Run round. We're going to have to stop this in a moment because you're raising too many good questions.
Many of the controversies are to do with sexual sin and men abusing their position. Mm-hmm. And in the world, the idea of toxic masculinity, what it means to be a man of God still in the church.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Okay, let's pause there. Let me just put in some caveats now of what we're not going to do. because quite a lot of these issues involve, it's basically, it will become a seminar on pastoral care. How do we handle hurting people, for example? And that's huge, isn't it? Particularly where they feel like you're the person that's hurt them. And the wisdoms involved in that. I'm afraid I'm not going to deal with that. We're going to deal more with accountability, lines, oversight, etc. So I'm not going to deal with that. And again, just to say that our own hearts and integrity with all of this, picking up on that last comment, is absolutely key. Let me divide these challenges into a couple of areas. Oversight and accountability. That is, what oversight of leadership practice is there? Whoever looks at how you work as a leader? And then, what accountability might you have? Someone, oversight in the sense of someone can look over you, but accountability, someone can actually hold you to account in any way. And of course, one of the key issues in dependency is there is no one outside the church that is holding church leadership to account. But then secondly, what I've called input and feedback, that is, what kind of input do leaders get? What sort of different voices do they hear? And what feedback might they get helpfully on how they act? So if you like, that first circle is a little more kind of structural. What kind of, who might stand over you, hold your feet to the fire? The other is a little bit more sort of like what feeding in might there be from under you, from within the church and so on. And I think both of those are key. This leads to what we might call a negative aspect in terms of how we might counter poor leadership. And we have to be honest and say we will lead poorly in different situations. Let's just put in a quick aside. Yes, of course, there are situations where perfectly good and godly leaders are being accused of things they haven't done because they've taught the Bible clearly to people. Right? That is happening. And we need to be gently robust in response, I would say. But we mustn't use those to say, no, I never do anything wrong as a leader. If we believe our doctrine of sin, then we believe we could fail as leaders, we could mismanage people. It might be through clumsiness rather than ill intent. But it could be ill intent. My heart is capable of that. So let's acknowledge that, but not use that to then become so defensive we're not willing to think, I need to be guarded in some way. But more positively, better leadership. An awful lot of these situations that we may refer to actually have become intractable. And it's very difficult to know the way forward on some of them. We've already heard that in some of the comments just being made. In one sense, my greater concern is how do we have healthier, better leadership that avoids more problems in the future? That all raises questions about a couple of key areas. External structures, first of all. That is, if you have a group of churches, what relationship do you have between them? How might they connect to each other? Say, a group in a locality. The leaders of those churches, what sort of relationship is there? The churches themselves, whether informally or more formally, what sort of relationship is there? But then secondly, what relationship is there between any group of churches and an outside body like the FIEC? It doesn't have to be the FIEC, but we're at the FIEC Leaders Conference, so let's list them. We belong to them. And there the question is, what oversight or exercise of authority, accountability, input, whatever, does that external group have over that group of churches? That's externally. And then internal structures, again, it divides into two areas, I think. There's the relationship between the leaders and the congregation. How do the leaders exercise authority, right authority, over the congregation in their role as God's appointed under-shepherds? How does the congregation relate to them in appropriate honouring and respect and submission, but also be able to ask questions and raise issues and so on? But then also, what's the relationship within a leadership? Because most of us probably hold to some kind of plural leadership, but then maybe employ someone, we call them a pastor. How does that group work, and what are accountability structures like, and so on within there? So to put that same list slightly differently, our ecclesiology usually involves independency, and that's to do with our relationship with other churches, whether it's a church down the road or a network of churches that we belong to. So we need to explore exactly what we think about independency. We also, most of us, believe in some form of congregationalism. We'll explore exactly what. That's to do with the relationship between the leaders and the congregation. Usually, some sort of final decision-making authority given to the congregation. And most of us have some form of plural leadership, plural eldership, relationship between leaders. Now, on each of those three areas, well, if you're a member of the FIEC, you have to agree with the first one. So you do, although you might have your own feelings about what relationships might be like between churches. You might want to hold churches at arm's length, or you might want to have really close partnership, like we were hearing this morning. Within congregationalism and plural leadership, the FIEC doesn't specify how you do or don't do things, and there will be a variety of practice amongst us. But the majority of us will have something like that, and I'm going to try and explore what each of those three areas looks like and how we might engage with them, given the questions that we've got on the table. Okay? So, first one, independency. Independency has focused on the right the local church has to be church. This came, again, in this country, historically, after the Reformation, end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, churches wrestling with what it means to be a church and saying we do not need to be part of the established church to be able to function as church. It's most easy to see this, I think, if you look at the comparisons. So, for example, Church of England, if you would like to, say, appoint a new ordained minister, you cannot do it as a local church. The bishop has to be involved. In fact, I don't know if you know this, if you'd like to conduct church discipline, which you can do in the Church of England, there are formal structures for it, the bishop must be involved in it. You do not have the power as a local church to conduct church discipline. Or the Presbyterian Church. The local presbytery must be involved for you to appoint a new elder, particularly a teaching elder in the life of the church. The church itself doesn't have the power and authority to make that appointment. Independents have said back to that, no, we can be church. Biblically, you'd look at things like Paul's speech to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, where the whole tenor of it is, you've seen my ministry to you, I'm handing on to you guys, it's over to you now. And at the end, he doesn't say, by the way, there'll be the annual visit from whoever, or they do join, you know, the diocesan synod or something. He just commits them to the grace of God and sails off into the sunset and seems to think they can operate as church. The letters written in the New Testament seem to give the responsibility to the church in question for how they will respond to Paul's teaching without saying, he may say, I'm going to send Tychicus or somebody to come and help you, but he's calling them to respond themselves. And there are very specific instances of this. For example, 1 Corinthians 5, church discipline. He says, shouldn't you have got on with it by yourselves rather than waiting for me? You should have acted as church. You've got the power and the right to do that. Dan Strange said we need to go deep historically. Let me give you a little bit of history. London Baptist Confession. I'm sorry that's a bit small, but I'll read it to you. Their section on the church. To each of these churches, therefore gathered, according to his mind declared in his word, he, this is Jesus, has given all that power and authority which is in any way needful for their carrying on that order in worship and discipline which he has instituted for them to observe with commands and rules, with the due right in exerting, executing of that power. He's given power and authority which is any way needful for you to live out the commands of Jesus as a body of God's people. You can do it. You do not need to be connected to any other church to be able to be church. I don't know if you've thought of independency that way. Maybe you just thought, oh, we just get to kind of do what we want. And we're not beholden to anybody else. But this is theologically, this is what's behind it. That you have power from the Lord Jesus given to you that you may act as church and live life. That is, none of that is to say that relationships with other churches might not be helpful things. And we're going to come to that in a second. What it's saying is they're not necessary things. Biblically, of course, the challenge to that is particularly, say, the Presbyterian argument would be Acts 15, the Council of Jerusalem, where an issue has got raised over a doctrinal matter, whether Gentiles had to be circumcised and obey the law. And they would say, well, then we have this gathering of church leaders to decide something together, and then their decision is then given out to all the churches. This is a presbytery. This is a synod. The independent response has been, well, actually, it's not really a gathering of all the churches. It's actually Paul and Barnabas from Antioch, where the issue was raised, going to check with Jerusalem. There are other churches than that in existence. This isn't let's all get together. It's these guys going to these guys because the teachers enforcing the law had come from Jerusalem. So let's go and check with them. That's one key issue. A second key issue is the authority of the letter. It seemed good to us and to the Holy Spirit not to ask more of you than this. And is that enforcement? Is this canon law? Or is that godly advice and encouragement? And independents would say, not a synod, godly advice and encouragement. But Acts 15 happens, there's a controversy. They get together, they discuss it, they do come up with godly advice and encouragement. There is helpful partnership between churches, even if they are independent churches. And one doesn't have the right to exert itself on the other, they still got together and discussed things. There is surely a picture of some kind of interdependence between independent churches. And we could go further. Andy helpfully mentioned various elements of partnership, didn't he, which comes under this kind of category. Acts 11, the collection for mutual aid for churches that are struggling. Voluntary, not imposed, but done. We see a circulation of people around the churches, Timothy, Titus, and others, Paul saying, I'm sending so-and-so to you. Now, some of that gets into the area of the authority of those guys and were they acting as apostolic delegates and so on, but there's still a principle of connectedness rather than isolation, of receptiveness to input from others rather than we're fine by ourselves, thank you. A lot of this is more about a stance we have towards each other. And independence, then, in church functioning doesn't preclude interdependence between churches. And this has happened historically. The Congregationalists and the Baptists, who are those who believed in independence of the local church, both formed unions in the first part of the 19th century. Unions of churches, not the Baptist church. Like a fellowship of churches, but it's still a union. And the London Baptist Confession speaks of this. Mutual relationship between churches, they say, as each church and all the members of it are bound continually to pray for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ in all places and upon all occasions, to further everyone within the bounds of their places and calling in the exercises of their gifts and graces. So the churches, when planted by the providence of God, so as they may enjoy opportunity and advantage for it, ought to hold communion among themselves for their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification. They see that we are bound to pray for the good and prosperity of all churches of Christ, and so that we can further our own ministries and wherever it is God's placed us, we ought to hold communion with each other, to increase our love, to build each other up. I take it that's what we're doing at this conference. But the point is, independent churches are they're not isolationist. They're looking to each other. And they go on later to say a little more. In cases of difficulties or differences, either in point of doctrine or administration, wherein either the churches in general are concerned, or any one church in their peace, union, and edification, or any member or members of any church are injured in or by any proceedings in censures not agreeable to truth and order. Look, it's old-fashioned language, but that is describing some stuff that's happening today. Members being injured by church censure, use of authority by leaders that are not agreeable to truth and order. Churches are acting badly towards their members and they're injuring them. So what should happen in these difficulties or differences? It is according to the mind of Christ that many churches holding communion together do by their messengers meet to consider and give their advice in or about that matter in difference, to be reported to all the churches concerned. So we should get together and we should discuss this stuff, whichever churches are involved. And then we should give advice as to what should happen in that church or for that church, those churches, or over that issue. Howbeit, these messengers assembled are not entrusted with any church power, properly so called, or with any jurisdiction over the churches themselves, to exercise censures either over churches or persons, or to impose their determination on the churches or officers. It is advisory. We still believe in independency. We get together, we discuss it, we say what we think should happen, but we can't impose ourselves on the church. And I just think one of the things we should realise, one of the things I was helped with in reading some of this, was that historically, independence and this kind of looking to each other went hand in hand. I think probably more so than it has done in a group like the FIEC. Now, just because they did it doesn't mean it's right, but that is interesting, isn't it? And I think something of a challenge to us. Now, what might this kind of interdependence, this is the external area, look like in practice, mutual relationships between churches? There could be something at a national level, say the functioning of the FIEC. And let me just say here, I'll mention some things here, but I don't work for the FIEC, I don't speak for the FIEC, and I know the FIEC are thinking these things through, right? It's a work in progress. How do they, as a national body, engage with this? What authority do they have to step into situations? And some of that's clear, they don't have authority to determine anything, but what should they do? And so on. So that's a live discussion. Let's pray for wisdom in that. But it could involve both giving resources and best practice as to how churches might operate and how they might respond. It could involve giving specific advice in certain situations. And the FIC is doing this already. And being invited in by local churches to advise, to look into situations, and to help in a non-authoritative way at the behest of that church, but hopefully helpfully. And of course, it's not just the FIC. I mean, in terms of best practice and things, you could think of groups like Living Leadership have published documents on this. There are other resources around. That, as I say, is something of a work in motion as to exactly what it will look like, but we need to lean into that. But then what might it look like locally? Could you then have a grouping of churches that looks to work together on this kind of area? Could there be, for example, any kind of mutual checks on each other or sharing of best practice? Could there be some kind of advice and support for each other in different situations? Could there be any kind of agreed accountability between churches? Look, this will always be relational. It depends how well you know the guys down the road. Depends how far down the road the other guys are. There are 6 FIEC churches and church plants in Cambridge or very close by. The pastors currently get together once a term for lunch and share and pray with each other. You may be in similar kind of situations. One thing I've asked those guys is, given all of this that's happening, and given some of the issues we'll come to about how things can happen internally, would we want to in any way act as external helps to each other? Could it be, for example, one of the issues we're going to come to is that people in local churches who feel poorly treated will say, I've got nowhere to go other than the leaders and the problems with the leaders. So I've got nowhere to go. Could it be that there is somewhere to go, which is to another church? Because we've said, if you've got a problem, we want you to go to that other church. We've come to an arrangement with them. We want you to talk to them. And if anyone of their church has got a problem with them, well, they want them to come and talk to us. Now, that, of course, will immediately run into problems of all sorts. Not least, oh, but you're just asking me to go and talk to your friend. Of course they're on your side. And frankly, we will never escape that. Because the only thing to do is just to choose someone none of us know. And as a result, quite frankly, none of us are immediately minded to trust. But what could happen? It could be that we have genuinely made a mistake in something. And that although he's my friend down the road, he could listen to that person and come back and say, Graham, I'm hearing this. What's your side? Okay. Now, I'm not asking him to conduct an investigation, but I am asking him to raise questions. Now, again, this is a work in progress. I've started this conversation with the guys near us. Everyone said, that sounds like a good idea. What it's going to look like on paper, I can't tell you. But it feels like the right sort of thing to lean into. That is stuff on independency. We've got 2 more areas to go, but that was the longest, because I think it's probably one of the most significant. So let's pause. Just get you talking for a second, save my voice. Questions that raises, thoughts you have, and then we're going to have some feedback in just a second. Just talk to your neighbour for a minute, then I'll call us back. Go for it. Okay, let's draw back together, and I'd love to hear any comments, and I'm happy to hear some questions. So I've got a hand there immediately, and then one at the back. Let's go for this one here first. Nathan first.
Hi, Graham. Is it right to ask two questions?
Go for it. Go on.
One, I agree about the agreed accountability and going to someone down the road. I guess in a complementarian setting, it's mostly, well, it'll be male elders, but then a male down the road who's pastoring a church. Often, if there's a woman in the church who's been hurt in Rishi, are there any suggestions on who she can go to in that? Should I go for the second question as well?
Go on.
Yeah, go. So in some situations, groups like 31-8 have been brought in, sometimes quite quickly for an issue in a church, sometimes quite slowly because in independency it's being wanted to dealt with in the local setting. Have you got any thoughts on when groups like that, who have a specific kind of area of involvement there, should be brought in, or should we be more cautious doing things locally?
Man. First question, excellent point. And I'm going to come to this a little bit internally, actually, but it applies here. Who people can go and talk to, and whether that's only ever a church leader who is a guy, is a real issue. And this is where we don't want to deny what we believe about church leadership. We want to be really helpful and understanding to people. So just, we've got to recognize that could feel really hard. I'm going to take straight that and feed that into some of our discussions. It might be that the designated point of contact is then not immediately an elder. Maybe it's their safeguarding officer. I don't know. But whether it's the point of contact or where it's the conversations then happen, I think actually in most of these conversations, you want to have two people in the room listening anyway, all the time. That one is a guy and one is a woman, I think, just makes sense within these settings. Under the second one, it is difficult. I mean, let's thank God for 31-8, for Christian Safeguarding Services and so on, for all the ways they've helped us in various ways. And let's thank God for what they're doing at the moment. What they give is an outside agency that can look at things much more objectively. They will only do so at the invitation of the local church, that's right. And there are several issues. One is, what exactly are we asking them to do? Broadly speaking, things divide into investigations into very specific events, what did or didn't happen, or cultural reviews, what is the flavour of this church and what might it learn? But those aren't the only two categories. So exactly what are we asking them to do? And in particular, how are we asking them to report and feed into the life of the church? There is an oddity in an external group giving a report to a church and saying the leaders this and the congregation da-da-da-da-da, often drawing, say, some critique of the leadership, which could well be very appropriate and good for them to hear. The leaders then need to, they then leave and the leaders stand up. I now need to lead the church in whatever this is. And that's not impossible, but I just need to recognize the oddity of that dynamic. And so what we're asking them to do and who they're asking them to report to the leaders for their reflection, to the whole congregation for its reflection, maybe to the leaders, but with an outside agency, outside, like the friend down the road, because that friend could be really useful in helping you process and think things through. So I just think that's some of the territory. But it's complicated. At the back.
So this is a question about biblical justification, believing in the sufficiency of Scripture, and just joining up the dots in some of what you've said. Am I understanding correctly that if you look at the current slide, you are justifying that on the basis of the sort of model we see in Acts chapter 15 about trying to live peaceably with others and
Yes.
Is that the line you're thinking of?
Yeah, along with the other elements that we just mentioned in the New Testament of elements of mutuality between churches. Independent, but not isolationist. Now, I think that simply means we say church can be church in and of itself, but it can look for help and advice and support and input from elsewhere. It must still own, it never hands itself over to somebody else. I don't think the leaders ever give up being leaders. But that doesn't mean they can't say, please advise us and guide us in this. That's what I'm trying to say. To your left there.
Thanks, Graham, for what you've said so far. One of the things that came out of what the London Baptist Confession said was that we don't have a kind of jurisdiction and we don't have the power to censure. One of the things that is a challenge for us as a group, FIC, is that people often think we ought to be taking the nuclear option, so the option of breaking fellowship with churches where conduct undermines the gospel. Mm. Because as we were hearing last night, that is a reasonable point to break. Can you say anything on that kind of, at what point should we be considering that? When should we be breaking fellowship with other churches because we feel they've crossed the line?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, not thank you. It's a horrible question. But so just to clarify where you started with the, there's no jurisdiction. Yes, that's right. And the FIC doesn't claim any jurisdiction over churches. It respects the independence of the local church. And so the only thing the FIC can do is say you can't be part of the fellowship. So it can't tell you. It can't. If your pastor stops believing in the Trinity, it can't remove your pastor. It can only say your pastor can't be part of the pastor's network and your church can't be part of the... And that might prompt a church into removing its own pastor. Praise God if that happened. But that's all it can do. And so that has normally fallen on kind of pastors and other leaders having to sign statements as to their doctrinal convictions and so on. Here is a kind of a... What would you do in the case of reported practice that falls or clearly badly short? The difficulty I think any external agency is in is how it positions itself in adjudicating. And to be honest, this is frankly the nightmare that is this whole area. You weren't in the room when that discussion happened, so you don't know the tone of voice that was used or the language that was used and whether the person felt belittled and damaged and so on. Who can say? And talking to people like Christian Safeguarding Services investigating very specific issues, they still end up kind of going, don't know. And so I'd hate the FIC to be put in a place where, you know, one person's going, well, you ought to kick them out. And they're kind of going, but how on earth do we investigate that? I take it in the first instance they would want to be talking to the church, they want to be talking to the leadership, they want to be talking to the leaders other than, say, the pastor, if it revolves around the pastor. What do the other leaders say? And be very cautious to simply believe accusations. That would be jumping into our kind of cancel culture. And yet, I take it there'd be moments where they might end up having to think there's a real problem here. I don't know. Trevor, do you want to comment on this at all? Oh, you work for the FIC. Here am I talking. Can we get Trevor's mic on? He's got a head mic.
Just you started off with the relational thing. I think that's just a vital ingredient here. It doesn't necessarily tick all the boxes in terms of grappling with it theologically. But my experience is that FIC can and has been playing a role by being invited in. Mm. But where it works effectively, there's a mutual commitment to a relationship that's existing within a local group of churches. Mm. That's the most powerful, practical, pragmatic answer to actually trying to recover a situation. Because I think that's the whole thing with discipline that we often forget is, it is a recovery thing. We want it to end up in a place where people are back where they should be, mm. and regrettably, therefore, where that doesn't happen, it is a failure of one sort or another. Yeah. So I think a big takeaway would be for me is that there are so many issues, as you've identified here. How does that work? We were just talking about the Cornerstone Collective and how they've got a group working as pastors together there. Yeah. What happens when you want to go outside of that as a church member and avoid this thing? Yeah, but it's all your mates, isn't it? So I think there needs to be that openness, that transparency for anybody who feels with a genuine injury. But there is always this element of there's sometimes an agenda running here. So, but I do think it comes back to this, FIC, all we can have is influence. We have no power. And that is actually a very helpful place to be. So we can influence. But we can do that at a local level as well. We can have influence with one another for good. But that takes time and it takes the determination to build those relationships, but also to be open with the church as this is what is happening. And if there is a grievance here, there is also an opportunity to go outside of what you might feel is this.
Yeah. Thank you. I have one more, I'm afraid, and then we're going to have to press on because we've got other areas to cover. So let's go for that one there. Yeah.
Thank you. The New Testament, in two circumstances I can think of, gives specific instruction for what to do when a person or member church has an accusation against an elder. So 1 Timothy, and also you could apply Matthew 18. This model looks like it's taking Acts 15, which deals with a doctrinal issue, not a personal accusation, and then applies it to that personal accusation. I can see the motive of why we made that jump, and I'm not opposed to the motive, but I just want to ask the question, are we justified in making that, what you might call, cross-application?
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So yes, Matthew 18, in terms of sort of personal sin within the congregation, 1 Timothy 5, in terms of an accusation against an elder, and I take it the setting in both of those is that's conducted within the local church. And they have the power and authority, as we spoke of, to do what is appropriate within the local church. I'm running from Acts 15. I'm also just running from what I see as that kind of relationality between churches, that they're frankly, they are, if I can put it this way, they're bothered about what's happening at the church down the road. And I think what I want to say is that as long as the leadership and independency of that local church is respected, and it is at their invitation, then why, I don't see any problem in giving advice and help. That's where I'd go. Yeah. We're going to have to move on. And if we have some more time for questions at the end, then we can do that. But let me cover two other areas more briefly. Plural leadership. So we're now thinking internally and how leadership works within the church. And how it works, in this case, within leading rather than within the leaders to the congregation. I think the vast majority of churches in the FIC would have plural elders. And they would do so saying that's what we see in the New Testament. Acts 14, say, 23, first preaching tour, Paul and Barnabas go back through all the churches, and they appoint elders, plural, in every church, singular. And then we see other elders being appointed. And whenever we read of elders in the New Testament, they are in the plural. James 5, you know, call the elders, and so on. I won't spend time arguing for that. What I want to say is that is part of our ecclesiology which should be of great aid to us in this area, because a plurality in leadership can help mitigate against some of these problems, give checks on each other, bring different perspectives, other people that can be approached other than the pastor, and so on. I was going to give you a nice quote on the great blessings of a plural eldership, but I'm not going to read it to you just for sake of time. What I'm going to jump on to is thinking about pastor versus elders, because many churches will have a plural eldership and then an employed pastor, usually saying that the pastor is one of the elders. Some go further and refer to them as a full-time elder, to make that point specifically. We should just be clear, biblically, there is no identification, I think, you can find in the New Testament of a pastor, singular, versus the elders. There's nothing. In fact, the noun pastor, shepherd, the noun is only used once in the New Testament. Ephesians 4, where God gifts the church with, you know, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors and teachers, shepherds. What you get is the verb to shepherd, quite a lot, Acts 20, shepherd the flock. 1 Peter 5, be shepherds of the flock, shepherd them. So we are to be pastors, shepherds. But those commands are all given to elders in the plural. So there's no pastor and elders, it's just elders. And all elders are pastors, shepherds. And I think the majority of it, I'm guessing the majority of us would say, yes, I agree. My question is how well that gets worked out in practice. How well does plurality get worked out in practice? And I worry we could be weak in working out our own ecclesiology. So let me give you a spectrum of positions here. You can have on the kind of, what is it, the left-hand side there, kind of pastor-led leadership, where the elders, at worst, are a kind of sounding board for the pastor. So you discuss things, the pastor puts the agenda together, let's discuss this, what do you think? Oh, that's really helpful, thank you so much. Great, 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 and I'll go and do this. And that's not, I mean, that's not nothing. That's great. And, that, and the pastor could be very open to hearing all sorts of great advice from the elders. And that could check some of their worst tendencies and balance them out and so on really helpfully. But that is not plural leadership. That's an advisory board to a singular leader. Whereas on the right-hand side is an elder-led church with genuine plurality. And this is where we're basically into the dynamics of how groups work and the combination of things that go into it. Because you may say we believe in genuine plurality, but what we have to wrestle with is personality types, culture, default ways of working, availability. I mean, just by virtue of my training, gifting, personality and availability, I'm employed by the church, other elders aren't, I will exercise a disproportionate influence. I mean, that's just obvious, I take it. That disproportionate influence isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it must be held within genuine plurality. Frankly, I can be relatively persuasive and argue a good case. I can think quite quickly on my feet. I could probably push each point in an elders meeting the way I want it to go. And one of my roles is to help the other elders really speak up for what they genuinely think and to cultivate an atmosphere and a culture there where they know it's okay to disagree with me. And that I would want them to disagree with me if they disagree. And I know that can be a pain, because now you're disagreeing over something that I think is so obvious. But that helps me sleep better at night, because it's not just Graham with a group of advisors. And in fact, we could go further and say, if it's not always the pastor, but let's just run with a classic scenario of the pastor has been heavy-handed, abusive, whatever that means and looks like. The most helpful first thing in that instance is a strong eldership, where elders will not simply say, don't worry, mate, we've got your back. They're not going to jump on him, but they're going to believe their doctrine of sin, and they're going to believe it's possible. One of the worst things you can say in these kinds of settings when you hear an accusation is, I can't believe it. Now, I know what we mean, because our experience of that person has been so good and they're so kind and gentle and thoughtful, I can't believe it. But if we actually say those words, what we're saying is, I can't believe my own doctrine of sin. Because my doctrine of sin says you could do anything. And so while I don't assume it, I have to at least engage with it and do so robustly. The most helpful thing is a strong plural eldership. Just to say on that diagram, spectrum sort of thing, some people have used the phrase first among equals. So the pastor is a first among equals. It's a nice phrase, isn't it? You kind of go, well, that sounds right. Because there is some kind of primacy and there is some sort of equality. My question whenever people use first among equals is simply to say, first in what way? If you mean first in that they take more of a lead, they're the captain of the team, fine. I think I try and function in that way. Is that what we mean by first? Or do we mean first like they ought to be agreed with? That's not first among equals. That's just first. So what do we mean? So just because that phrase is thrown around, what do we mean by that? Let's unpick that, because in and of itself, it's not a very helpful phrase. So some areas to consider. Relationships between elders. We've commented on the importance of relationship, the closeness of relationship. Not simply that you're all good mates, but that you actually can share things. You can be honest with people. One of the most significant areas in this is being able to admit to where you get things wrong, particularly if you're an employed pastor, and having close enough, good enough, trusting relationships. I had to go to our elders recently, unfortunately, and say that somebody had raised something with me about a conversation from about 2 years previously, and I had to say, I've made a mistake. They said this to me. I can kind of remember that conversation. I can't remember the details. And there was a kind of very small red flag. It wasn't a big red flag. It was very small. But I didn't see it. And I didn't act. And I look back now and I really wish I had. And I basically reported myself to my elders and said, I've made a mistake. You guys have to decide what to do here. I could do that because I trust them. You know, and I felt nervous. I don't know where this is going to go. And I don't know what that person's going to do with that complaint. I don't know how these guys are going to act with it. But that's the right thing to do. And my relationship with them allowed that to happen. Who oversees the pastor then? Do the other elders even have it on their agenda that there is a mutual accountability within the eldership? They all oversee each other and therefore they oversee any employed staff. The authority of other elders, do they genuinely have authority as I do within the life of the church? Or are they in some sort of second-class position? Just to throw in here, the place of reviews. I had a kind of appraisal review with two of my elders and a trustee last Thursday. Hadn't happened for some time. Embarrassingly long period of time for a variety of reasons, but it was really great. We did a 360 review. They asked people that I do one-to-ones with and people in my small group and people I work with. Very simple, you know, it was two questions. It was very simple. It was what would you want to encourage Graham in that you think he does well? Are there any areas you have concerns about? But it allowed for people to say, well, what about this? Does he realize that? And so on. And this is where you could also involve other churches if you wanted to. When we planted as a church, we had a very young eldership. And the danger effectively was, to put it bluntly, I was the kind of most experienced guy in the room. I'd led a plant before. I'd been in ministry for some time. I had two very kind of great guys, but one of them had been an elder about a year and one of them had been an elder about 3 months. I've laughed about it with them since, that if I would say something, they're just going to go, yes, you know. And encouraging them to push back on me was pretty hard. So the first review we ever did for me, we asked a pastor from another church to join them. Not granting him any authority over me, but as an advisor with more experience who would push harder. Because of time, I was going to pause there and have questions. Because of time, let me finish the last section and then we'll see what time we have for questions. I'm sorry I'm going on. Congregationalism. Here, it's the relationship between the leaders and the congregation. And this is where we probably vary probably a little bit more in how we work. Again, there's something of a spectrum. There is what you might think of as pure congregationalism, where the congregation is the final authority for kind of all decisions in the life of the church. You vote on everything, that kind of thing. At the other end, it's elder-ruled churches. And some churches in the FIC are like this. The elders can make the final decision on everything. Now, of course, they might consult the congregation a great deal. So they have lots of discussion, but they don't end up voting. The elders make a decision. And then in the middle, what's often referred to as elder-led congregationalism, the elders lead on the majority of things with some consultation, depending on the issue, but they do vote on the most significant issues, appointment of new leaders, that sort of thing. And of course, actually, even on the pure congregation side, there's always some leading. And on the right-hand side, there's always some consultation. And of course, it will vary on issue to issue as to what's appropriate. So, you know, let's not turn it into, I'll try and avoid doing my seminar on church leadership. Of course, the argument for congregational involvement involves passages and the passages we've mentioned, things like Matthew 18. You go and challenge your brother or sister, then you take somebody else. But finally, you take it to the church. And the final voice that the person is supposed to listen to is the church. If they will not listen to the church. 1 Corinthians 5, again, church discipline, an act of putting someone out of the church that is seems to be enacted by the whole congregation. When you are all assembled, should you not have put this man out? Some will point to Acts 6 and the election of the... We could call them deacons, but that word's not actually used of them. But the people are going to be overseeing distribution of food. Choose from among yourselves. I take it here, the key principles, I don't want to get into what you vote on, what you don't. The key principles are that there is some degree of leadership from the elders. And there is some respect for and involvement of the congregation. Many of us work that out by voting. I don't think there's anything biblical about voting, personally. I just think it's a way of working out that dynamic for some issues. What I'm much more concerned about is to say there's a principle of leadership and a principle of involvement to be able to hear what the congregation says. So the leaders are not simply saying, we know what's best for you, shut up. And the congregation isn't agitating for things, they're respecting and following their leaders. You put those two together. I think some of the issues that raises over this issue are things like hearing voices in the congregation, how people can feed in, and particularly how people can feed in concerns. Where can they go? Who can they go to? How can people raise issues? You're never going to have a perfect system, and you're never going to avoid the, oh, but you're telling me to talk to your mate issue we've mentioned already. But what we can at least be is clear on who you can talk to. And even if people think the system isn't great, say, yeah, well, that's our system. And then final decision making, how that final decision making is conceived, what freedom people think they have, people feeling coerced effectively into decision making, or how do you present things like voting to your congregation? Is it like, well, if you respect the elders, you'll da 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 da, and you're basically turning the thumbscrews emotionally. This is now how elders can misuse their authority at the whole church level rather than the individual level. Let me just finish with this, and Trevor is looming behind me. We're going to have some systems in place. That's what we've been looking at and exploring. Let me just say that along with that, there are lots of other issues we've not touched on. There is the culture of a church. Systems feed into culture. You know, the fact that you do reviews, the fact that you invite comments, the fact that you listen to voices, that all contributes to the culture of the church. Is the culture of your church one where leaders can be questioned? Can admit fault? Or is it a more precarious, they have to be perfect, and any kind of question about them would be disastrous? That is a dangerous place to be. Then there is the self-awareness of leaders. How do you know how you come across? Who will help you in that? What might you have in place that will make you more self-aware? And ultimately, your character, that you love people and love the Lord and want to serve them. We've dealt with the top of that list. I just wanted to remind you of the bottom half.